know, the time has passed and we can sort of sit on our hands because we're not really going to get that opportunity. We're basically looking at two possibilities. We got a world that's unimaginable and we got a world that's unthinkable.
Fighting the greenhouse effect is going to be a universal effort. Everybody's going to have to do it pretty much all the time.
We're going to take a whirlwind tour of a whirlwind, one Michael Bruce Sterling. He's a science fiction writer, working visionary and cyber green activist. Along the way, we'll encounter the planet of the dumps, green design, spimes, total tracking of everything. Oh yeah, and the mega threat of climate change. This is Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock. Along with the usual collection of audio clips, you'll have to put up with my reading a few Sterling quotes. He's a writer after all. His science fiction career started at the University of Texas. In the 1980s, Sterling was a founder of the cyberpunk genre. He's sold millions of books since his first novel, Shizmatrix. The 1986 anthology of cyberpunk, edited by Sterling, titled Mirror Shades, is still a classic. He also co-wrote with William Gibson the 1990 steampunk novel, The Difference Engine. His first nonfiction novel was The Hacker Crackdown, which followed the U.S. Secret Service raids on a Texas game maker. Since then, Sterling has become a widely published journalist, including his column in Wired magazine. He's a popular speaker at conventions. As the future unravels before us, Sterling interprets new technology and culture warping. He founded an online community called Viridian, which promotes neo-green design and high-tech solutions. We'll also hear about his later publication, Shaping Things, published by MIT Press. And none of this captures the real Bruce Sterling. He's a very unassuming man in person. His life is a travel schedule, a laptop exploration of cyberspace, some mind-blowing, and some beer. His rich inner mind really pours out in his books and speeches. He offers things and dictates nothing.
You know, I'm one guy, this is my hobby, I don't have a secretary, I've never looked for foundation support. I mean, basically I'm a tech commentator and sometime theorist.
Back in the early 1990s, Bruce Sterling became personally concerned about climate change and published a novel about it in 1995 called Heavy Weather. Set in his home state of Texas, the survivors of heat, drought, and drug-resistant diseases set out checking all the violent storms that depopulated the region by 2031. The future comes early, doesn't it? As we all know, heavy weather is already appearing. More and more, Sterling is a magnet and stimulant for green solutions blogging like worldchanging.com and Treehugger. There is an urgency to his green cyber activism. For example, back in 1999, Sterling told the Industrial Designers Society of America National Conference, "Nature is over. The 20th century did it in. There's not a liter of seawater anywhere without its share of PCB and DDT. An altered climate will reshuffle the ecological deck for every creature that breathes. You can't escape industrialism and hide from the sky. It's over. From now on, nature is under surveillance and on life support. Face up to it. A 21st century avant-garde has to deal with those consequences and thrive in that world." End quote. These threats are multidimensional.
You know, I've written science fiction novels on topics like this in the past, but just listen to this. This is what our civilization is confronting now. We've got like 14 chronic problems. Habitat destruction and deforestation, soil erosion and soil loss, water shortages, overhunting, overfishing, alien species breaking in on older ecosystems, human population growth, the per capita impact of people's consumption going up, climate change, bioaccumulative chemicals in the ecosystem, energy shortages, and number 14, kind of my favorite, humanity is approaching the point of using up the Earth's entire photosynthetic capacity. And they're all sort of classic future issues because they're all on a slow timeline. They're not the sort of thing that can be solved by, you know, two years in the House of Representatives. They're just at a slower pace than the you know, the ethical, legal, social, and political institutions that we built to date. So I think of it as an infrastructural problem, it's a design problem, it's an engineering problem. And I actually expect to see most of these problems diminishing during my lifetime, and I think they will be defeated sometime in the 2060s. You know, and I'm not an optimist or a pessimist about this subject. I actually think these are just chronic issues which are bubbling up so hard that it's going to be impossible to deny them. And I think the most interesting people in our society are going to be the people who are willing and able to tackle these.
Billions of humans all over the world are leaving the countryside to live in cities. It is one of the most startling developments of the new century.
Right. Well, we're heading for 11 billion people, and they're going to be in cities, because there really isn't any other way to put 11 people. We got, you know, what is it? We're pushing 7 now.
Pushing 7. The hope is that we're going to level off at 9 if we do it right.
You know, we might hit 9, we might hit 11. You know, it depends on a lot of factors. But basically, that's 50% more people living in areas that sort of don't exist yet. Because, you know, a lot of us are still going to be here. So that stuff has all got to be designed, and it's all got to be built. And it can't be built in the old way. It's just not going to work. So we're going to have to come up with just radical new means of housing, radical new means of transportation.
One of the things that's, for a while I've been going around quoting the statistic that I heard, that we're building a city the size of Seattle every 4 days. And a couple months ago, a guy came up to me who's a demographer, and he said, no, that's totally wrong. It's about every 7.5 days. So, you know, yeah. You know, I mean, that's between population growth and people moving from the country to the city. We're basically cranking out a major, you know, urban center every, you know, about 7.5 days. And we need to figure out ways of providing the kinds of services and the kinds of, you know, structures that people need to live in gigantic cities. I mean, Mexico City. What's Mexico City now?
That's Alex Steffens of worldchanging.com at SWX 2005. Rural living was self-contained, but city dwellers must haul in vast quantities of food and resources while trucking out equally vast piles of waste.
Because all these objects that we unilaterally abandoned are sitting in big dumps just over the water table. They're rotting, they're emitting methane, you know, and there can only be more. There can only be more dump. Because everything that ends in a dump, you know, eventually the percentage of the planet that's dump has to grow larger and larger over a period of time, unless you can figure out how to fold the dump back into the production stream.
Right.
And I suspect we will be mining dumps in pretty short order, you know, because there's a lot of very useful material in dumps. And if you go and look at, like, the amount of junk that has to be mined in an iron mine, or the amount of just havoc that's wreaked to, like, dig gold, just a few traces of gold out of huge amounts of rock, you can recycle anything if you're willing to put enough energy and attention into it. And I suspect we're going to find by the middle of the 21st century that people actually go out and, like, stake claims on dumps.
The real solution to waste, Sterling suggests, is to design it out of the system in the first place. We can use biologically degradable materials to replace toxic synthetic ones. We can reduce the mass of everything we use, light vehicles, lighter buildings. And we can make sure everything is reused or recycled in some way. All this starts in the original designs pouring out of computers around the world. Here is Sterling speaking at the SWX Conference 2005.
I mean, there's three things you can do, basically, if you want to have a sustainable economy, a sustainable physical event, and I think we're going to do all three in different ways. First, there's neobiology and biomimetics. You just make the stuff out of natural material, so if you lose it, it rots. And it just goes away, and it's okay, so what? A tree ate it, we mulched the rose bushes with it, that's fine. Then the second method is, you can build monuments. In other words, I'll just, like, build this thing that I know is going to last 800 years. This is kind of the John Ruskin approach. And I was like, I will make everything out of great big timber and great heavy stones, and we'll build for the ages, and we'll abandon fashion, and, you know, it'll be artsy and craftsy and rough-hewn and honest and gothic. Except the difficulty with that approach is you don't get to change your mind about it. It's like grandpa makes all the decisions, and then you just have to live that way. So those two ways are doable. I mean, there's a certain amount of that being done already. You know, you can install infrastructure that lasts a long time and so forth. And if you build it right, it'll last, and it won't be a big load on the environment. And then the third way is a way that was never thought of before, that I've been writing about a lot. I just wrote a book about this for MIT Press, and that's to label everything in the environment and digitally track it. Just give everything a unique identity and just kind of Google the barcode, scan it, watch it throughout its lifetime. You start from before it exists with a digital plan for the object. You follow it through the production stream. You follow it through the distribution stream. You follow it from the retailer to the person who owns it. You follow it from the owner to the person he sells it to. And then when it finally breaks, you just sort of push a button and say, "Be gone from my presence." And it automatically calls in somebody who takes it and pulls it apart, designed for disassembly. So this is like, that would be like a fully cyberneticized environment, an internet of things. We have an internet now. We have an internet of web pages, but we don't have an internet of things. The closest you can see to it is something like Amazon, where you see like a very large number of items, and they're all surrounded by like a haze of data. Go and like look at book on Amazon. You're not actually getting the book. If you buy a book at Amazon, you're actually getting a digital representation of a book. In fact, you can buy a book on Amazon before it exists. And I suspect this is like the future for a lot of manufactured objects. In other words, they're sort of made in a very short run. They're not stockpiled. They don't even come to exist before I pay for it. Like the Dell computer method. Now, you can like specify everything you want from a Dell computer. It's because the thing doesn't exist until you pay for it. Once you pay for it and tell them what to do it, they make it on the spot and then ship it to you. And then if they could just watch the thing throughout its entire lifespan and then pull the components apart and take them back when you were done, it'd be kind of game over at that point. You wouldn't have lost anything. You would have simply sipped it the way Alex is sipping his Coke and then returned the aluminum shell to the recycler, and it would all be just in a nice closed loop. Right? All it would require is like incredible bandwidth, fantastic tracking capabilities, and unbelievable databases, and basically a complete remake of the political, economic, legal, and social system. And those happen all the damn time. You know, it's not as big a step as it was from the 17th century to the 18th century, or the 18th to the 19th. In fact, there are harbingers of it all around, right? It's just like cradle-to-grave, auto-tracking objects, the Internet of Things. Like every object you buy has got a web page. Every object you buy has got some kind of Googleable identity. And I think we're going to see this. We're going to see it in outfits like Walmart and the Pentagon. Then we're going to see it trickling into like small office, home office applications. And eventually it's just going to be something you do. I would predict that most of the people in this room, when they're old, you're going to be surrounded by trackable objects. And when you're looking for something you misplaced, you're going to Google it. You're not going to waste 18 hours looking for your damn car keys. "Honey, where are my shoes? What did you leave them last time? I'm 75. I don't even remember what kind of shoes I had." You're just going to say, "Where are your shoes?" And the system is going to say, "One is under the couch and the other one is in the freezer where you left it while you were getting the Häagen-Dazs." You know, and it will seem simpler. It'll seem simpler to a human being in the way that, like, Google is simpler.
So Stirling's original idea, adding to a mix of solutions, is the possibility of identifying and tracking all products so their final destination is not the dump, but reuse, stripping for new production, or composting for biomass. This is Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. In the next section, we'll dive into climate change and some solutions with Bruce Stirling, Green Visionary.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
This is part two of a feature on author and cybergreen activist Bruce Stirling. Stirling says we consumers have been purposely left in the dark about our products, other than the dreamlike data of advertising and labels. Knowledge about our possessions is proprietary to the manufacturer, we are told. So we don't know what is in them, or how toxic they might be. The spime is the opposite of that. And that is part of the new solution that Bruce Stirling offers for the problem of toxicity and waste in our society. You will know what's in it and where it came from. The end use or biologically safe disposal will be designed right into this object before it is ever made. A spime is a contraction of the words space and time. As we've heard, total tracking of all products would require a minor social revolution. Many libertarians are horrified at the ugly possibilities when everyone knows where everything goes and who uses what.
We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied.
But aren't we already well on our way? Walmart, the world's largest retailer, demands RFID radio tracking chips in every product they sell. Supermarkets use price incentives and shopping carts to track all our purchases. Basically, almost all products are already followed by computers. The only thing we don't track, says Sterling, is the disposal. You or your city can just keep burying the remnants of these toxic toys somewhere out there in the countryside or in your own body.
We're actually made out of gaseous technological junk.
As a cyberpunk writer, Sterling is all too aware of the potential for abuse in all this tracking. He foresees wrangling with, quote, spime spam, pushiness, abusive customers, intrusion, spying and eavesdropping capabilities, brooms that bellow ads, mops that demand money, subtle software faults that make even a simple shovel unusable, security flaws, hacking, theft, fraud, malware, vandalism, and pranking, industrial hazards, spime kitchens that fry the unwary, spime cars that follow outdated software maps and drive right off broken bridges, technological lock-in, wicked monopolists, corrupt regimes in on the take, and just plain ugliness. Tacky, goofy, tasteless, cheesy, lethal, vulgar, dirty, worthless, obscene, impractical, and dangerous spimes. End quote. But what is the alternative? Can we continue to pretend that Earth is a vast wasteland where we dump all the waste of 10 billion consumers? And we're not talking about those unseen places where we truck endless streams of toxic junk. We're talking about our own blood and lungs where daily pollution settles into disease.
You know, and you wonder, like, okay, how does woman's breast get jet fuel in it? Well, you know, any human body actually bioaccumulates jet fuel. It's going to, like, grab this jet fuel additive by preference, so that even if there's just a little bit of it, I mean, your teeth are made out of calcium, right? But you don't usually go out and, like, eat eggshells. You get trace amounts of calcium and build your teeth. But you can get trace amounts of jet fuel additive and build your body out of that. And that doesn't go away because it's like become a permanent part of your infrastructure, basically. So, you know, this is an argument in form in favor of biomimetics and neobiology. Okay, we at least need to, like, understand the mimetic nature of our own body and try not to build technological artifacts that our body builds bodies out of. I mean, that stuff just needs to be, like, moved out of the production stream entirely, so that we don't end up using our own unconscious processes that actually make ourselves into, what's the proper term for it? It isn't cyborgs, but just people carrying a heavy load. You know, and they're not all toxins.
I think we call it dumps, actually.
Dumps, yeah. We're dumps. We're turning our bodies into dumps.
Again, it's Sygraph. Sterling says, it's painful. But we need to understand that our bloodstreams are our dumping grounds. So are our lungs and livers. If we could visualize that, if we knew and could prove what had gone on wrong inside of ourselves, if we could put a digital medical imaging screen on our bellies, our lungs, and our livers, and make those invisible problems visible, then everything would become different. If that knowledge was attached to every object in our possession, the objects that are killing us would vanish quickly. He continues, we cannot turn our entire planet's crust into obsolete objects. We need to locate valuable objects that are dead and fold them back into the product stream. In order to do this, we need to know where they are and what happened to them. We need to document the life cycles of objects. In practice, this is going to mean tagging and historicizing everything. It's possible to live in a cleaner way. We live in debris and detritus because of our ignorance. That ignorance is no longer technically necessary. Those who know, know. Instead, our problem is becoming obscurantism, which is deliberate hiding of the facts by vested interests who know they are injuring us. Such acts of evil must be combated. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. End quote.
Entropy in the industrial process, because that's what the greenhouse effect is. I mean, basically, it's a smokestack, it's a tailpipe, and we put the trash into the sky, and now the weather's wrecked.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land.
Apparently, the whole planet is in danger from man-made global warming.
The senior threat for Stirling and for all of us is rapid destabilization of the planet due to man-made greenhouse gases.
You know, I mean, fighting the greenhouse effect is going to be a universal effort. Everybody's going to have to do it pretty much all the time. I don't think people are ever going to realize how much change is necessary because people don't realize how much change has already occurred. I don't think that's really the point of doing it. I mean, it's not trying to enlighten the entire masses to do it. I mean, when people adjust, it's basically something like people fleeing the Ninth Ward and running far away, but they don't really have very far to go. I mean, the adjustments don't come because you realize one morning that climate change is happening. The adjustments come because you get an insurance bill for your home in Key West, and it suddenly costs more than the mortgage because insurers just don't want to go to Florida, because Florida was scourged by four hurricanes in a row and they can't go anywhere. So certain areas become uninsurable, and then you find buildings being abandoned, and that's just the way that climate change works. I mean, you read Jared Diamond and you can see that there have been periods of climatic stress in other societies, and if there's no water, people go, and you know, if there's less topsoil, the population dwindles. We're not going to be able to design that out. I mean, the ideal tech solution, should there be one, I mean, there are two. First would be emission-free energy. That's a pipe dream, but, you know, you never know. Pipes have been known to blow up, you know, every once in a while. Something weird happens. And the other would be not adaptation, but just sucking the effluent out of the atmosphere. I mean, literally, the carbon dioxide that's there and the methane needs to be sucked out and somehow put back in the ground. It should not have been up there in the first place. And, you know, to go out and tell people, well, put more tarpaulins on your roof, that's not really going to help. We're in a condition of climate change right now. I would predict that it will go through numerous phases. In other words, we don't simply have the nice climate and then the no climate, which is not so nice. We'll have a degraded climate, a seriously degraded climate, a freakishly degraded climate, you know, utter mayhem. And at that point, emissions stop because most of us are dead. So, you know, we actually need to redress, sort of take vigorous steps to do something or other. But, you know, it's not something your aunt at Bethnal Green is going to do. She's not going to go out with a soda straw and suck carbon dioxide out of the sky. This is going to have to be done by people who have some vague idea what they're doing, and they have to have, you know, effective techniques and some backing and some legal coverage and this, that, and the other. You know, where that comes from, I don't know, but the pressure is just going to get worse and worse. And, you know, I'm not an engineer. I'm not going to be doing that myself. What I'm going to be doing is making it thinkable, making it imaginable. Everybody talks about mitigating carbon. Very few people talk about vigorously removing carbon. I can promise you they will be talking about that a whole lot in 10 years, all the time, all the time. And, you know, I'm one of the first people to sort of say it in public. I'm saying it to a very small public. That does not matter. Time is on my side. I was talking about climate. I wrote a novel about climate change in the early 90s. You know, you just watch the calendar.
Climate change appeared in the background of several of Stirling's science fiction books, including Islands in the Net and Involution Ocean. But the burning post-carbon world stars in his 1994 book, Heavy Weather, which continues to sell well. At the turn of the new century, Stirling came out with the Viridian Manifesto and his personal eco-discussion list focusing on green design. The website says the design philosophy is to create irresistible demand for a global atmosphere upgrade. As a cyber activist, Bruce Stirling is pasted all over the net. In addition to his own discussion list, his science fiction fans and the futurists and designers, they all have Stirling discussion groups. He's also involved with a number of the most popular green blogs, including his co-conspirator Alex Steffen at worldchanging.com.
It's time we accept bad weather as a vital natural resource, one we as a nation should be proud of.
At times, Stirling isn't sure he wants George Bush to act on global warming because Bush poisons everything he touches. Just imagine the new security state with nuclear prisons Bush would demand to fight climate change. We need to act at every other level instead. Back in 1999, before Al Gore made a movie, speaking before a convention of industrial designers, Stirling recalls the 600 people in that city who died of heat in July 1995. He reminds his tech-savvy audiences all their cool gear is still powered by carbon-belching coal. When it comes to heat, they ain't seen nothing yet. He tells them, quote, "People have tremendous powers of denial. We're living in that denial right now. As a society, as a civilization, it's all about puff, 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 beep, beep, honk, honk, and never mind the consequences." End quote. Then, he says, by 2005, civil liberties will be lost in a form of neo-Stalinism. Ha! Obviously, that could never happen in America. One of his later novels, Distraction, weaves in the themes of the Viridian Movement. Again set in post-global warming America, the main character, there are no heroes in a Stirling novel, worries his way through new strategies and models of power in the chaos of climate-wrecked culture. And yet, despite writing about a wrecked ecosphere, Stirling says, quote, "I'm an optimist, and I'm the hard kind of optimist because I'm a post-pessimist. I think the greenhouse effect is the central problem of our civilization right now. We don't face the problem, but we sure as hell have it. It's not that big a problem. Not compared to the nuclear arms race, or the military-industrial complex, or the population explosion, or fascism, or communism, or the other 20th century crises that we don't fuss much about anymore, because they're old hat. The greenhouse effect isn't a dramatic problem, like playing Russian roulette with hydrogen bombs. The greenhouse effect is a chronic problem, like cigarettes." End quote.
You know, I mean, fighting the greenhouse effect is going to be a universal effort. Everybody's going to have to do it. Pretty much all the time.
He still thinks that intelligent humans can somehow use 21st century technology to save the planet from the old machinery of Rockefeller Oil, Edison Power, and Ford cars. In an article written for the Sierra Club, Stirling describes this way out. The first and most sensible technology is one that does its work and then eventually rots and goes away by itself. Its core materials and processes are biodegradable, so it's self-recycling. Writer Janine Benyus talks about biomimetic technologies. Architect William McDonough describes cradle-to-cradle production systems. This means harnessing the same biochemical means of production that built the natural world, and using them to create industries, cities, products, everything. It means room temperature industrial assembly without toxics. No foundries, no pesticides, no mercury. When an object made by these processes is abandoned or worn out, it becomes part of the biosphere. End quote. All of this is to be supplemented with the new cybernetic products, the SPIMES, which are mostly data with very little mass required. After all, we already buy the idea of the product as much as the thing itself. His hope, quote, "If we handle the huge transition correctly, it will be worth cheering. In 50 years, nature will be less oppressed. Culture will be wiser. Government will take new and improved forms. Industrial systems will be more efficient and capable, and business will be less like a rigged casino. Purveyors of art, fashion, and design will see what went on nowadays and bust a gut laughing in derision. Our children and grandchildren will get up in the morning, look at the news, and instead of flinching in terror, they will see the edifying spectacle of the world's brightest people transparently solving the world's worst problems. This sounds utopian, but it could soon be everyday life." Bruce Stirling audio clips came from his excellent speech at SWX 2005, available on the net, and from a new interview on BigPicture.tv. Check that out at www.big-picture.tv. This report is from Radio EcoShock, the net's only all-environment radio station, available free at www.ecoshock.org. You can read the text for this broadcast, with some links, in our news blog at ecoshock.org/podcast.html. There is no copyright. Use this freely.
And we're not going to be able to, like, double-talk our way out of that. We're actually going to have to create a society that no longer depends on that resource or the way in which it's dug up, mined, and distributed. And there's only so much of it, and burning it is visibly bad for us. So we just got to invent our way around it. We got to out-create it.